Welcome. Thank you all so much for being here today. It's a real joy to see you. My name is Dawn Tripp, and I am a member of the Boston Book Festival Board. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to our session this morning. I support the BBF because I love all of the amazing author events and the opportunity to connect readers and writers and to celebrate a culture of literature in our city of Boston. We rely on your support. This event is completely free and open, and we always want to have it that way. We want it to be completely free and open to all readers. And if you're enjoying your day here with us, I encourage you to donate in any amount online or visit our member table at the BBF booth and become a member, and we'll give you some great swag. And please support our authors and local independent booksellers and buy lots of books. I have a big bag here, and it will be full of books by the end of the day. So this is our 15th anniversary of the Boston Book Festival, and I'm thrilled to be hosting this particular session, Mystery and Suspense, The Secrets That We Keep. I'm delighted to feature these three outstanding authors who've created innovative page-turning novels. They're three very different stories of acute psychological insight and a transcendent sense of history and place. Mm. So all three of these books really explore how secrets, what we desire, what drives us, what we hide from, can reshape a life in an instant. So I'm going to introduce each of the authors in turn. They're going to read or present for about 10 minutes, and then we're going to open up to a shared conversation. So hold on to whatever questions you have, and that's going to be a point in the conversation where things become really alive and dynamic. Our first author today is nationally best-selling, award-winning mystery writer Deborah Goodrich Royce. Deborah describes her novels as puzzles of identity, and I love that. I've been thinking about it ever since she talked to me about that. And I love how complex stories can really reshape our understanding of what we think we know and leave us more open to what we might not know, what we might not have discovered, which at its best can be a source of wonder. Deborah's third book, Reef Road, hit Publishers Weekly's bestseller list, Good Morning America's top 15 list, and was a 2023 ABA Indie Next pick. The novel opens when a severed hand washes ashore in Palm Beach, Florida, and the lives of two women collide. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Sarah and Lev. All of you, too. Delighted to be here. Did you want me to do my thing now?
I'd love you to read a little bit.
I'll read a little bit.
Share a little bit about the novel.
All right. Yeah. I am going to read a small section. Chapter one, A Writer's Thoughts. When I look at photographs of Noelle, I try to gauge her expression for signs of what was to come. There are two pictures of her in newspapers, though neither is dated. In one, her hair is parted slightly off-center and piled atop her head in a Fraulein-style braid. I can't tell if one or two braids were plaited to wrap across the crown of her head, but the effect suggests a little German girl in the years before the war. Noelle's chin in this particular image is dipped down. Her eyes look up to the camera, and her smile is slight, lips barely parted. Because the photos I am studying are taken from old newspapers from the weeks and months, even years after it happened, the pictures are grainy and pixelated. The upward regard of her gaze allows the whites of her eyes to show underneath the irises, thus lending her an expression that the Japanese, or maybe it is only the macrobiotic practitioners, would call sanpaku. George Osawa, founder of the macrobiotic movement in post-war Japan, identified this characteristic, the whites of the eyes being visible either above or below the irises from the position of a straightforward look, as a sign of extreme ill health or imbalance. which he attributed to the worsening diets of his countrymen through the influence of Western culture. This trait, he believed, was an indicator of those marked for death and has been noted by other macrobiotics. I know this because I used to be one. In the gazes of a gamut of doomed historical figures ranging from Rasputin to Marilyn Monroe to Charles Manson. All of them, we can safely agree, qualified as marked for death, although death in Manson's case did not happen to be his own. Ironically, in the photo of Noelle in question, she is looking up at the camera, not straight ahead of her, so she cannot really be called Sanpaku at all. Though marked for death, she was. I'll stop there just to say the genesis of this book was really spring of 2020 when I was grounded in Florida on a book tour and got to finally research the real murder of my real mother's best friend in 1948, Pittsburgh, when my mother and her friend were 12. It's an unsolved case. It's something that has had a profound effect on my mother, and I would consequently say on me and perhaps even my daughters. So it is a fictionalized version of the real murder turned into a twisty thriller with a meditation on the concept of generational trauma. I'm very interested in epigenetics and how we carry scars from earlier generations, sometimes even things we don't know about. So I'll stop there and let somebody else go.
And maybe before you stop,
all right,
I would love you to expound just a little bit on that concept of puzzles of identity, how mysteries are puzzles of identity, how stories and our kind of work to unpack them, explore them, learn from them, can allow for a kind of, not necessarily, not always a solving, but that it's that kind of fragmented interplay of different dimensions of who we are and who we seek to be.
Well said. I think we all have secrets in our lives. Most of us, our secrets are quite benign. But occasionally, we go along and we come across people we were talking earlier who really are harboring the big ones. And it is always utterly dumbfounding when you meet those people. And hopefully, it's not worse than dumbfounding. And having had this family story, so for us, it was really not so much our family trauma, it was more conferred trauma. If you think about someone like Dominic Dunn, whose daughter was murdered, or Michelle McNamara, who knew a girl who was murdered in her town and ended up writing I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which solved a case of a serial killer in California. I am interested in that intersection when we suddenly, what we're looking at in another human being becomes something utterly different. I started as an actress. In the 80s, I did the TV miniseries with Mark Harmon about Ted Bundy. I played the woman who married Bundy when he was on death row. And as an actress, I puzzled over, you know, what the heck do you do with that? I mean, what was she thinking? And for me, all I could really come up with, the only thing that made any sense there was that she simply didn't believe it. She unequivocally rejected, even in face of all the evidence that he had done it. So that is a fascinating puzzle, hi Jean, of human behavior. In the 90s, when I left acting, I was a story editor at Miramax Films. You all know about Miramax. I worked for Harvey Weinstein. Interesting puzzle of human behavior, an incredibly bright, creative person who has this dark secret life. So what is that? And I think it's the reason we are all interested in true crime. And the last thing I'll say, I ended up fictionalizing true crime because I think sometimes it's easier to get to the theme of what you want to say through fiction rather than non. You can really cut to the essence of, in my case, this idea of generational trauma and what it does to all of us. So, yeah, I find it very interesting.
Why does fiction afford us access to, you know, a kind of emotional or psychological truth that you don't always have the same access to when you're staying entirely close to the historical record?
Well, in the specificity of the real murder, December the 10th, 1948, Pittsburgh, one of the real victims' brothers was the primary suspect. In real life, she had two brothers. When I wrote an early draft with two brothers, a dear friend, beta reader, said, "What's with the second brother?" It was just confusing, this extraneous person. So there's a case where you can winnow it. You can strip away and begin to explore, again, thematic issues without being mired in all the factual details.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much. Our second author is Lambda Award finalist Lev A.C. Rosen, author of Lavender House, which was described as richly cinematic, a new take on a golden age crime novel. Lev's latest Andy Mills novel, The Bell in the Fog, is set in San Francisco, 1952. It's a dazzling historical mystery that explores the question, once you finally have found a family, how far would you go to prove yourself to them? Dan Chan describes Rosen as one of a kind. His eye for characters is both acerbic and compassionate, and his storytelling is top notch. Welcome, Lev.
Thank you. It's always mildly mortifying to hear stuff like that read out loud.
Yeah, it's nice.
Hi, what an honor and pleasure to be here, especially among legends. I am thrilled. This is my first Boston Book Fest, and I am absolutely thrilled to be here. I'm going to read a little from The Bell in the Fog, which is follow-up to Lavender House. I've been told to call it a follow-up, because calling it a sequel makes it sound like it doesn't work as a standalone, and my editor worked very hard to make sure it did. So it works as a standalone as well. I'm going to read just a few pages in, but what you need to know, I think, going in is that Andy Mills he was a cop in 1952, San Francisco, and he was caught in a raid on a gay club and subsequently fired, but since then has sort of emerged from the depression that left him in to open up his own private investigator office over the Ruby, which is a gay club owned by his friend Elsie. But because the gay community in 1952 San Francisco knows he was a cop, none of them are super welcoming. Elsie had the door redone when I moved in. Amethyst Investigations, stenciled in dark purple. I don't love the name, but I get why she chose it. Being affiliated with the Ruby, being another of Elsie's gems, it means I'm trustworthy, like the Ruby is. Most welcoming gay club in San Francisco. Most welcoming gay PI, too. In theory, anyway. Certainly not everyone is buying it, though, or I'd have more business. I wonder who's desperate or angry enough to come see me tonight. I'll say he was just told there's someone waiting in his office. There's a man sitting in the chair that faces my desk. His back is to me, but I can see he's blonde, broad-shouldered, tall. I close the door with a click, and he turns around. Oh. The recognition hits like an anchor that's dropped too fast, crashing into the seabed, into both of us, sand flying up, fish fleeing, a heavy thud, and a scar on the ocean floor. He looks just as shocked as I feel. Well, at least that's two of us. I didn't realize it would be you, he says, almost apologetically. He stands up. I can go. I mean, I should go. I think about letting him. He can drift out the door like smoke, and I can go back to thinking of him as a sour memory. But I can't be turning down clients. And I want to know what happened. I shake my head. No. Sit down. If you're here, there's not many other places you can go, right? Sure, but James, don't worry. I can help. I make my face calm, professional, even smile a little, though it kills me, and I go around to my side of the desk. He looks almost the same, even though it's been 7 years. He's gray creeping in at his sideburns, but is still shockingly handsome with a square jaw and bright blue eyes that not even the dark circles can hide. So, he says after a moment, and I realize he's been looking at me the way I've been looking at him, finding all the changes, all the things that stayed the same. Been a while, huh? I stare at him. I don't know what to say to that. He's the one who vanished. A faint whiff of him comes across the desk, pine, the ocean, just like he used to smell. For a moment, it's like the lines on his forehead and the grays vanish, and it's just us again, like we were alone on base or in the sonar cabin of the Bell, all our crewmates somewhere else. Just dim light, him, me, the sway of the ocean, our hands and bodies. He used to hold me tight when the ship really rocked, kiss my earlobe. I realize I haven't said anything, and so does he. You look well, he says, smiling. He could never handle the silence. He always had to fill it with a grin or a joke or his mouth on mine. Thank you, I say. And as I get used to this, the two of us together again, I suddenly realize there's another presence. You ever hear from Helen? He asks, as if sensing it too. I shake my head. Not for years. Helen had been the third of our motley crew, a member of WAVES, the Navy Women's Auxiliary. Never went on a ship, but worked at Treasure Island as a driver. After James vanished, though, we couldn't make the friendship work, just the two of us. The crater he left in our lives with his sudden disappearance, with us not knowing what had happened, it was so big, too terrifying to keep sidestepping. But I don't tell him that. He doesn't get to know what he left behind. Lee's voice comes through the floor, just like she promised, but it's muffled, the lyrics unclear. Just the sound of a voice and music, too foggy to have any real meaning. Why don't we talk about why you're here, I say. Yeah, that's probably better than dwelling on the past. Sure, I say, better than that. Yeah, I don't know how to end.
It was a good ending.
And from there, we get to solve a blackmail case and get into the queer history of World War II, which is a lot of fun.
Talk to us more about that.
Oh, man. So the thing about World War II, and I owe a lot of my research to Alan Berube's fabulous book, Coming Out Under Fire. The thing about World War II is that before World War II, what you had in terms of the queer community was many small towns where there was like the one gay guy, and he didn't know anyone else, and he was sort of struggling with stuff. And then there was the draft. And all of a sudden, all these men are getting funneled into urban areas, and the one gay guy from every town suddenly meets all the other gay guys from all the other towns, and these queer communities spring up. And the beginning of World War II is extremely gay in that regard, and there's so much queer history there. One of my favorite little tidbits is that there was actually a gay newsletter within this armed services called the Brighton Beach Bitch. and these guys, these two guys at the base in Brighton Beach would write a newsletter, type it up, and send it out to all the other gay armed services members they knew, and it was just gossip about gay people in the army. And it went on for like years before it was raided because the armed services didn't really understand that they had all these queer people in the Army, Navy, Marines, etc., until a few years into the war. And that's when they started being like, oh, what do we do about this? And that sort of leads to sort of the medicalization of queerness and the idea of curing it. And we get all of that as we come out of the war that leads into the Lavender Scare, which is when these books take place. But yeah, there are stories from the Navy of men who would fully just be making out on their ships, and their captain would be like, guys, it's fine if you do that, but we're trying to look at the enemy ships on the horizon that you're in front of, so can you just take it somewhere else? Like, that's the sort of leniency in some cases that was happening. And in other cases, you would be immediately court-martialed. So it's all over the place in terms of what it was like, but it was very free, unexpectedly free, and it created these communities in many ways, and it actually led to a lot of gay rights activism in the 50s.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
It's wild. I love pre-Stonewall gay history. That's why I write these. There you go.
And why a mystery set
Oh, yeah, I love
it. In that span of time, in that moment, that cultural moment.
I love mysteries, too. I was raised on all the old noir, the Bogart and McCall, and my parents, like, showed them to me from possibly too young an age. And I think that the experience of being queer in the 50s is very similar to what we think of as noir. And the,
you
know, noir is the idea of paranoia, of people, of the world closing in on you, of trying to find some sort of light in the darkness. And that's what it was like being queer in the 50s. You know, the Lavender Scare, even though it's largely sort of swept over, forgotten by history today, was bigger than the Red Scare in many respects. We don't talk about it anymore. But
And just to make sure we're all functioning in common ground, like, just say a few words about
that,
please.
Oh, the Lavender
please.
Scare.
Thanks.
Yes, absolutely. Lavender Scare was when the government essentially started going after queer people, particularly in the armed services, in the State Department, because there was the idea that they were inherently untrustworthy. They could be blackmailed. They were morally deficient. And therefore could would easily sell state secrets. And it got to the point after there was an ousting. There were a bunch of queer people fired from the State Department, and McCarthy made a big deal out of that. And it became a whole thing. Oh, God, everyone in the State Department's gay. We got to get rid of the gays in the State Department. Got to the point that any man who worked for the State Department, if he said, hi, I work for the State Department, they would almost always follow up with, and I'm married with children.
It's interesting.
Because they had to, like, make it clear they were not gay. Because there was this assumption. So, yeah, the Lavender Scare is wild. And because of that, we have this noir world for queer people in the 50s. And so those two things intersect perfectly in that being queer was an inherently noir experience.
Mm. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Our third author today is Sarah DeVello. Acclaimed author of Broadway Butterfly, a brilliantly layered debut thriller of glamour, corruption, and secrets that brings to life New York in the 1920s jazz age. Broadway Butterfly is a true crime novel based on one of the most notorious unsolved mysteries of the era. It was named one of the best summer books of 2023 by Entertainment Weekly and was praised by the Associated Press as precise, transportive, a fascinating murder mystery packed with history. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much. Hi, everybody. Hi. Okay, so I'm going to read two pages. And can everybody in the back hear me okay? Do you guys need some? Okay, perfect. Okay. 4 p.m., Mineola, Long Island, Nassau County Courthouse. All rise, the bailiff called. Julia Hartman stood with the rest of the assembled crowd as the judge swept from the room, his black robe billowing ominously behind him. Reflexively, she patted her head, then thigh, an instinctive female inspection to make sure her riotous curls were still tucked under the blue cloche hat and her skirt hadn't shifted immodestly. As one of only a few women in the courtroom, and the only one who wasn't on trial, testifying, or there to gawk, it was imperative to keep up professional appearances. The Pettit Wells murder trial had reached closing arguments. It would soon be up to the jury to decide the fate of Miss Billy Wells, the scorned mistress who stood accused of shooting her violent, hard-drinking, loose-spending, live-in lover, Roadhouse Jim Pettit. The trial had looked fairly bleak for the accused until Mrs. Pettit, Roadhouse Jim's estranged wife, had stepped forward to testify in support of her husband's mistress. From the start, the case had every ingredient to make sensational front page news. A mistress, a bad man, and a murder. But the wife-mistress alliance was a twist nobody had seen coming, and the public and press had seized on it with equal glee. Julia had carefully hewed her coverage to capture each scintillating detail, and when the case reached its soon-to-be searing verdict, she'd be there to report on it for the Daily News, just as she always did. As the rare female reporter and the even rarer woman on the hard-hitting crime beat, Julia had found the solidarity of mistress and wife, defendant and widow, particularly interesting. The other few women at her paper, and in the newspaper field as a whole, covered cooking, astrology, fashion, and advice for the lovelorn. Julia had started her career on the ladies' pages in her hometown of Memphis, Tennessee, then worked hard to transcend them and gain entree to the all-male desks, first heading to Knoxville to cut her teeth on covering the courts, then heading to the Big Apple to test her mettle on the crime beat in the biggest, most glamorous, and most competitive city in the country. Since then, she'd become the lead crime reporter at the paper and one of the best in the whole city. And yet the pressure was always on to prove she deserved to be there and had the chutzpah to stay. That pressure would not end with this story or the next. The necessity to arrive earlier, stay later, and work twice as hard, and get paid half as much, simply for the privilege to be allowed to be there, trailed her like a constant shadow. But it also meant that she found herself with the power to shape the narrative of the news, not only by which story she covered, but also how she covered them. So when, like this case, the accused was a woman, and the Brooklyn Daily Times headlines had crowed, "State flays Wells woman at start of murder trial," Julia had ensured that her paper's headline trumpeted, "Innkeeper's wife aids Miss Wells, calls Roadhouse Jim a wastrel." Facts were facts, but the storyteller steered the narrative, and the narrative steered public perception. It was an invisible power, and Julia Hartman was the rare woman to wield it. Applause already? This place just keeps getting better. So this is a true story about a scandalous flapper named Dot King who was found murdered in her bed on March 15th, 1923, wearing a lace negligee that barely reached her knees. And that is only the first of many shocking facts, which titillate and obsess first New York's newspapers and then newspapers across the nation and then the world. And I tell this story through four real life, real people points of views. So the first is Julia Hartman, who is an incredible real life heroine, who is one of the six pioneering women journalists at the turn of the century. And this is a name that everyone should know. This woman's career should be taught in every history of journalism class and every journalism curriculum, and yet this is a name that nobody knows. This woman has been completely forgotten by time, and I hope in some small way that this helps her to take her rightful place in history, because she is incredible, and she covers this and many other famous cases, including the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. And her life is threatened. Her life is literally at risk. And yet when that happens, she doubles down and leaps back into the fray. And it made me think, am I doing work that I would literally risk my life for? Are any of us? Would you die to tell the truth? And Julia took her position in the fourth estate of journalism very seriously as a watchguard for truth and for justice and for giving a voice to the voiceless. And I love that about her. She's extraordinary. The second point of view is Detective John D. Coughlin, who's the head of the NYPD Detectives Unit. He has 1,200 men reporting under him. And he led this investigation and many other investigations. And what I found really fascinating about him is that, you know, he's a first-generation Irish-American. He's the son of an Irish cop who came to America and then became an Irish-American cop. He then became a cop. And he never married. He never had children. He dedicated his life to his career, and I found it really interesting that he, who is in charge of meting out justice, found himself the victim of injustice, and I really wanted to take a look at that. The third perspective is Ella Bradford, who is the closest friend of the victim who finds the body. It's not a spoiler, it's chapter one. And she is the keeper of all of her secrets, the confidant. And she is one of the 7 million black Americans who was part of what was called the Great Migration, who in the wake of the Civil War and legalized segregation made her way north in search of a better life. So Ella Bradford sat in a quote-unquote colored waiting room in Jacksonville, Florida, to get on a quote-unquote colored train car to come north to the non-segregated New York and create a better life for herself. And she is incredible and brave and courageous, and that story deserves to be told. My fourth point of view is Frances Stotesbury. So this is at a time when women had very little power. Less than 20% of women worked outside the home. And, you know, you rarely even had their own name. It was, you know, Mrs. John Smith, Mrs. Robert Taylor. You didn't even have the dignity of your first name or your, you know, your own name. So at a time when this was sort of life for women, Frances is one of what is a member of what's called Society, capital S, which is the richest echelon of America's wealthiest. So her father's the wealthiest person in Pennsylvania, a founding partner with J.P. Morgan, J.P. himself. And, you know, they circulate between three homes in Philadelphia. They have two homes in Philadelphia, Palm Beach and Bar Harbor, Maine. And 2 weeks before this case, she is deemed one of the four most powerful women in society whose mere gaze can stop any social climber in her tracks. And so Frances is preparing to host the President of the United States, who this is not his first time visiting the family. He's on his fundraising tour as he gets ready to announce his renomination. President Harding held the Ig Nobel designation of being the most scandal-ridden Republican president at all until 2016. There's a lot of similarities between 1923 and 2023. And so she's getting ready to host a fundraising party for him, and then she finds her life sucked into this very faraway murder case, 1,900 miles away in New York City. So those are my four characters, and this is the book. Yay!
And so how did you become riveted by this particular story?
You know, Dawn, I think what I've noticed is that whether people write fiction or nonfiction, we are drawn to the stories that resonate with us. Out of all of the unsolved murders, why did I choose this one? Out of all of the unsolved murders, why did Deborah choose hers? Why did Lev choose this story? It's because it resonates. And as readers, why do you choose to read the stories that you do out of the thousands, the millions of books out of there? Why do you choose the books you do? And if you look really deeply at yourself and at the content and the themes of the book, you'll realize you're drawn to the stories that resonate with you, that you're still trying to work something out. You're still trying to reach resolution. And so I happen to be a do-gooder geek who cares very, very deeply about what is fair and about what is just. And in the words of the wonderful poet Amanda Gorman, I wanted to look at how what just is not always justice. And I wanted to look at that through this story, through the lens of the story, and through these four people, and how each of them were victims of unfairness, and how the powers of money and politics and those in power can corrupt justice, and how in 100 years so much has changed with technology, and how not much has changed at all.
So, before we open up to questions from you, I have a couple of questions for the three of you. Do you read mysteries? Like, is that your passion? Are mysteries your passion?
Yes. I was a Nancy Drew girl. I grew up on Nancy Drew, Agatha Christie. My whole family reads mysteries. I host a mystery interview series every Monday. I devour mysteries and thrillers. I live for this stuff.
I do. I read pretty broadly, more fiction than non. Definitely mystery in my reading, but I kind of am taking everything. I host an author series at the Ocean House. Do you guys know where Watch Hill,
yes,
Rhode Island is?
Yeah.
Just down the road. So we've had 25 authors this year. We'll have just as many next year. So, traveling this week, I read, finally, the Lisa Jewell,
yeah,
None of This is True, which I very much enjoyed.
And so do you find when you're writing mysteries, but you're always, your mystery drives you in terms as a writer, as a storyteller?
You're asking me?
I'm asking you.
No, it doesn't drive me. So Reef Road, I was so happy to hear you talking about noir, because Reef Road has two storylines. It has the perspective of the writer, which is very internal, very meta. It's like diary entries where she's,
right,
obsessively looking at the facts of the real case and lots of other murders in general. But then it has a very noir storyline, which I'm a huge fan, and I wanted to set a noir in Florida because I love that quotation, which some people attribute to Carl Hiaasen as having said about Florida, but I think it was actually Somerset Maugham who said it about the French Riviera, but it's a sunny place for shady people.
Ooh.
So I wanted, like you were saying, that I wanted it to be steeped in that paranoia, in that darkness, and in noir, often the female character is extraordinarily suspect and up to something which isn't good. So I don't know if mystery drives me, but I do think in terms of a twist, I guess. There's always that moment where I want to see that what I thought I was looking at isn't what I've been looking at all.
Mm. And how about you?
About noir or what I read?
Mysteries, what you read.
I read everything. I read everything and I write everything too. Yeah, I also write young adult romantic comedies.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I mean, like I said, I was raised on those movies. I've read everything by Chandler twice and everything by Hammett once. I love reading mysteries, but I do, it's not exclusive. And I think what draws me to them, especially like historical mysteries, is the fact that history in many ways, as we look back on it, becomes very sort of archetypal.
Yes.
And getting to screw with those archetypes is a lot of fun.
It's interesting too how all three of these books are playing with intersections and kind of, you know, I'm also curious, did you, because the books are experienced not, I mean, yes, we read in a linear way. Mm. Like, we start on page one as readers. Everyone starts on page one. You know, you read all the way through. I'm always so curious about how, in that linear trajectory, how stories are apprehended by the readers and also how they're composed by the writers. Do you compose your stories in a linear way? Do you start on page one, or do you start where you feel led to start?
I mean, I feel like I generally start on page one. I generally try to start with like an idea and a sort of opening, and then I will write for a little while or outline for a little while if that's what I've been asked to turn in. And it's not until I'm like halfway through that I'm like, oh, I know what this is about. Mm-hmm. I know who did it. I know what's going to happen. And until then, it's like about sort of, what if this twist happened? What about this moment? And so it's jumping moment to moment. And then when I'm halfway through, I sort of understand what the story is. And then you go back and edit. Like, so much of the writing is in the edit. I think linearly to an extent, but it's a very
And then there's like a moment of revelation where you have an understanding of what you've been working
toward. It's very fluid, and then all of a sudden it sort of solidifies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about you?
Yeah, I write as you read it. I start at page one. Although, I had someone at one of my events who said she does not read a book in order.
Interesting.
Does anybody else do that? This was the only person I'd ever met.
You don't
met.
Read a book in order?
You don't read it in order.
She raised her hand. I have questions.
You don't read it in order. All right, we can get to that. But one of the things I do, because my books are very non-linear, is I keep a timeline and I sort of have a calendar that, like, you can go, this is very old-fashioned, you can print out month at a page calendars, and because in thriller mystery, whatever you want to call it, plots are so very complex, I make notes on dates, and I lay it out. You can do it on your computer, but the beauty of having it spread out in front of you is at a quick glance, you can realize that, you know, if that gun has to disappear on June the 9th, 1948, and you can never see it again, you really want to remember that you don't see that gun on June the 10th because your readers are super smart, and they will catch you in that mess up.
I do the exact same thing.
Yeah, the calendar thing's amazing.
Not until I'm halfway done, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I get it, yeah.
So I started, this book came to me from starting with chapter 24, which is a huge spoiler, so I won't say what it is. But it, the scene of that was so shocking and so traumatic to every sensibility that I had. I couldn't stop thinking about that scene and what that would have been like for that character. And I could not get that out of my mind and out of my heart. And so I started with that, and then I wrote the book. Because this is a true story, I wrote it chronologically, starting with the day of the murder. As a reader, I read the last page first.
Oh,
come at me. I'll fight you all. I struggle with anxiety, and I need to know what happens in the end so that I can relax and enjoy the book. I said what I said.
You know, for some reason in my mind, I was picturing being like, you being like, I read exactly 33% of the book. I find that one-third mark, I read that first. The ending makes a little more sense. I understand that.
Interesting.
I have to know.
That's so interesting. I always know my endings. I don't always know. I know a dimension of what I'm writing toward. Otherwise, I just kind of go unpack forever. But there's always a surprise that I haven't arrived at yet. There's always some sense of epiphany, usually about a character that I just didn't see, that I didn't see coming. Mm-hmm. Even the historical novels.
Yeah.
So I would love to open up to questions from you, and I have plenty others, but yeah, go ahead.
I can repeat it.
Coming around is the microphone. Okay. Here you go. How about you repeat that one more time? Thank you.
Okay. I wanted to ask if you start with the idea of a character or with a mystery first, like the plot of the mystery itself.
Great
question.
And
how that affects the story.
I started with the plot because it was, you know, this murder. So I guess I started with the plot, but then it quickly was, I guess it was the same time, character and the plot for me, because they were so intertwined with the murder being told through these points of view.
So in Reef Road, because I've always known about this real murder that affected my mother, and I've known it wasn't solved, I also happen to know a DA who reopened the case in 2008, and I know all those details. When I sat down to really look at it, it began with research of the real case, and then it morphed into what I wanted to do fictionally, this obsessive writer, so it became very character-driven, and then the younger woman with the noir storyline. So it began with facts, but then became very character-driven.
Mm. Well, I mean, Bell in the Fog, since it's a follow-up, not a sequel.
I'm going to use that.
Yeah, the character was, you know, rendered already in my mind and everything. But with the first one, with Lavender House, I had always been sort of looking for a way in to, like, find a noir queer retelling and sort of waiting for publishing to be ready for that. Mm. And the moment where I was like, oh, yeah, let's do this, was I was watching an adaptation of an Agatha Christie movie, and I was like, this is fun, but how much fun would it be if everyone were gay? And so that was the initial spark there, and that's when I was like, all right, who would that detective be for that case? And it would have to be a gay detective, and that would mean someone ousted, and that's where the character came from. But the concept came first, I think.
And now you've written a follow-up.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up.
not a sequel. And that idea of living with a character, I'd love you to talk a little bit about that.
Ooh. Oh, man, it's wild, especially going back and forth between this and, like, my YA rom-coms. So, like, I have three books out this year, and I have another rom-com out in less than a month. And going back and forth is actually sort of easy because of those breaks, I think. And what I do is I have the book, I put it to the side, and like Andy sort of stays there in my mind, and then I go do something else. And I am completely disassociated from him, I'm dealing with other characters, other situations, a completely different tone. And then I will watch an old noir movie and I'll be like, I'm with Andy again. Like it all just comes back to me.
Andy's back.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Hi. Oh. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. First off, thank you so much for sharing your books and your experiences with us. I'm just thinking, like, is there a way I can call out of work sick for the next week and just, like, pull up with your books because they each sound amazing in their own right. Lev, my question is for you. I can't imagine what it would feel like to go to a bookstore and identify as a queer former World War II serviceman. Have you heard from readers? Mm. Have they shared what it feels like to see part of their stories now come alive?
This book came out on Tuesday. So not yet. Certainly I've heard from many people about Lavender House. None of them who would have been adults during the 50s, but people who remember gay adults from the 50s or remember, like, hearing stories or wondering as an adult if someone they knew back then was queer and sort of thinking about that experience and the way the book had sort of made them think about it differently. But no servicemen yet. I am sort of curious. I'm also worried about, homophobic servicemen who will have opinions they will feel a need to share with me. But we'll see what happens.
Here comes another question.
Yes, I want to ask a question. How do you get motivated to continue writing your books?
So for me, it was that I cared so deeply about these characters and this story, and I thought they were so extraordinary in their own right that the desire to tell their story and to do justice to them is what kept me motivated.
Yeah, I love that question. I'd like to say something about motivation and time. I am that person who really started publishing novels later in life. And I like to say this to people of all kinds of ages because I think when you're young, you can tend to think that you have to do everything all at once. Mm. And I think I am that person who's been more of a sequential performer. So for me, even though I wrote for a long time, it was really that moment of the empty nest, which was 9 years ago, where systematically, bit by bit, I restructured my life in such a way that I could give the time that I wasn't able to give to before. I have friends who've written 10 books and raised 4 children, and God bless them, they are super people, but I was able to do other things. So for me, the time factor came when I was able to rip it all up and restart it. Mm.
I think motivation is an interesting word because it's like, if motivation, I sort of, you stay at it because you are in love with this story. But I think that doesn't necessarily mean that writer's block doesn't come along. And the thing, even if I'm working on a book that I love, sometimes there will come a time when my brain just gets tired and it's like, this isn't happening. And so I also teach creative writing. And the advice I always give to my students is, you don't have to come to the page every day. I think that's very high pressure. Mm. But I do recommend interacting with your book in every way, in some way. So maybe you're in the shower. Think about it. Just think about it. Make yourself sit down and think about your book for at least 5 minutes every day. Mm. And if you can't write that day, that's fine. But just considering it and making sure it stays a presence in your life will mean that when that motivation returns, you have this, you've stayed connected to it. Mm.
And motivation is a really interesting word because, at least in my own experience, so I've been writing since I was, it's what I always wanted to do. It's what always drove me as a human in the world. It's how I make sense of my world. And I don't always love my books. I don't always love a story I'm wrestling with, but I feel impelled by it. I feel driven by it. I feel that it's not always kind of desire in a positive way, but it's something that I really need to understand, to make sense of, to transmute, to synthesize. And one of the things that I love so much about the concept of mysteries as puzzles of identity is that I really see all fiction, for me, as puzzles of identity. Mm. You know, that on some level, you're working through these spaces that are so, you know, you have the daylight reason that's driving you to tell a story, which may be the thing that you, when you go out and have a book sold, you will talk about the reason, but there's also all these other reasons that drive you to explore a particular story. And that feeling is in many ways, for me, the key to getting up and thinking about a story, or getting up and sitting at my desk for hours. But yeah, it's a really important question, because that fire is what matters. And books that have that fire, you can feel it when you read.
Mm. Well said.
Yes. Another question.
Yes.
Yes.
What do you find the hardest part about writing mystery specifically?
The hardest part about writing mysteries specifically?
So for me, it was about pacing and about when to reveal the trail of breadcrumbs, when to drop a breadcrumb, and how to keep the pacing going. So my mistake in the first place was giving away all the clues, because I was in the first chapter, I was like, here's all the information, let's work through it together, you know, over the next 400 pages. And then I realized that was not working. So I had to go back and make a list of all of the information, all of the clues, and then ration it out and drop the clues, drop the trail of breadcrumbs along the way to keep the pace going, and then try to end every chapter with a question or a cliffhanger. And that was a learned skill for me.
So for me, the hardest thing with the thriller genre, there are certain plot points that you have to be really sensible. They have to work. And I structure my books a lot like movies. I'm such a movie person. I like, you know, that three-act structure. So I like, if it's roughly 300 pages, I like to have a big pop at roughly 100, a big pop at roughly 200, and I also like to divide it in the middle. I also like cliffhangers at the end of every chapter and it to go into the next one. But, like, I'm working on something now where I have one of two directions a very important plot point could go, and I had to pick a way to write it, and I don't know if it's the right way, so I actually have my editor reading it, and I might get a happy surprise or an unhappy surprise, so we don't know.
I think the hardest thing for me writing these, is because they're historical mysteries, is the sort of mix of making sure I can bring in all this history that we have forgotten or has been erased while still maintaining a mystery at all, and not like in the middle of like a climactic scene being like, here is the information on this particular, you know, on the Kinsey report. Let's go over that real quick so that you understand the context, and making sure that that information feels lived in. That is something I struggle with, every draft.
I also struggle with the historical part, because what I realize is that if you're writing something modern day, you all have a shared base of knowledge. So it's like, you know, Julia zipped up her coat and walked out on Boylston Street.
Maybe.
But in 1923, you have to wonder, did they have zippers? Was Boylston Street named something else? Was it one way? And so then you have to go into all of those questions. So, you know, we all have a shared knowledge that there are TV, internet, trains, airplanes, zippers. There, but 100 years ago, none of that is for certain. So that was also unexpectedly time-consuming.
So we have time for one more question. I also have one more question for the author. So I'd love to hear from the audience. There you go.
Hello. I was just wondering, based on, you know, listening to all of your answers, you all seem to have such a clear idea of these explorations of identity that you wanted to include in each of your works. And I was just wondering what the process was like as you were writing, you know, did you ever struggle to kind of juggle that exploration with keeping a dynamic story through the plot, or did the historical aspects of all of your books kind of lend to a deeper exploration you weren't expecting? Just if you could provide insight into sort of the process of working with that while still writing a mystery.
Great question.
I think that with identity, it has to, once you know your protagonist, once you know your character or characters, protagonists, then the their identity and the way it intersects with the world and the way it is changed by the mystery itself, by the plot, is the exploration in many ways. And obviously, you know, this, I'm also talking about queer community, historical stuff, and that's a lot of research, and I enjoy that. But the actual way it reflects on the character's identity is just about giving him a place to react to and for his identity to expand or contract and respond to things, just like it does with the case. And so in that sense, the identity isn't, the intersection of identity isn't so much something I plan ahead as much as it is something that is reactive based on the plot and the setting that I've created.
Yeah, so that's a great question. I guess I start with certain questions that I'm asking. And one of the things that's very interesting as you go along is the interaction of characters. And you start to, you know, the characters, as everyone says, they begin to surprise you, not only as their thought processes are revealing themselves to you, but then also nothing exists in a vacuum. And Reef Road is really about these two women in this COVID lockdown in Palm Beach, Florida. And it changed along the way as the women came together. So I don't know if that answers your question, but the identities reveal themselves through plot, through character.
I think that the energy behind mystery, which is what is going to happen, how is this going to evolve, how is this going to be fixed, is essential to identity, right? Because it's who am I, who are these people, these characters, and how are they going to get to where they need to go in terms of whatever issue they're working through, whether they are trying to cover a case or trying to solve a case or trying to deal with a personal crisis. So that energy of what and how, which is the essence of mystery, I think, is essential to exploring one's identity or exploring one's character's identity. So for me, I think it feels really natural that that becomes part of the excitement, part of the energy, part of the story inherently, and supports it and drives it forward.
And I'm just going to add one thing to that question.
Yeah.
For me, sometimes the hardest part of a novel is finding the voice. And sometimes finding the voice takes me years. Sometimes I have it right away. But when I have it, and I can feel it, and it's like, you know, it's running right from me into the page and the story, everything else can be solved. Everything can be solved. But that has to be there. That has to be alive on the page.
Yep. I love that.
I just want to thank all of you so much for being here. And Lev, Deborah, and Sarah,
this is
wonderful. I also want to remind you that books are available for sale. And Lev and Deborah and Sarah would be happy to sign them. And they're phenomenal gifts and books that you should take home and read also.
Thank you,
Dawn. Thank you.
Thank you.
This was amazing. Thank you.
So glad you were here.